I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland, Portland's community-owned and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patsy Kohlberg is engineering. The Old Mole is dedicated to bringing you different perspectives on history, culture, politics, and current events than that of the corporate compromised news media. Today, Bill Resnick interviews Marty Hart Landsberg, Professor Emeritus of Economics at Lewis and Clark College here in Portland. They'll be discussing Measure 97 and why the huge flood of corporate TV and direct mail advertising against it is so deceptive. Todd Sloan, who has just returned from the annual meeting of the journal Psychoanalysis, Culture, and Society, will be sharing insights from a workshop he led on the psychological effects of oppression and the implications for overcoming them in political organizing. Desiree Hellegers interviews Maxine Fuchsun of Jewish Voice for Peace and Peter Miller of Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights about Portland City contracts with a global security company, G4S, which has recently been in the news in connection with the Dakota Access Pipeline. I'll conclude the program today with a reading from an article by David Rosen entitled "The War on Drugs is a Racket." Now here's Bill Resnick and Marty Hart Landsberg on Measure 97.
Martin Hart Landsberg, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Marty Hart Landsberg teaches economics. He writes books. The visitors and devotees of his blog reports from the economic front, they keep growing. That's because he examines the economy, also relates it to the political and movement-building fronts. And he's quite active himself politically in Portland Rising, other organizations, also in international labor struggles. You may have seen Marty on TV recently speaking for Measure 97, an initiative on the ballot you just received. Marty, tell us about Measure 97, what it would do, why it's needed.
I think Measure 97 is a game changer. We have this sort of idealized notion of our state as really delivering good services. But if you look at the statistics, Oregon has the fourth worst graduation rates in the country, the third largest class sizes. We have a very short school year. The Education Week, which is a publication that looks at every state's educational system, gave the state a D+ for school finance and a D for K-12 achievement. And that's only because the publication doesn't give Fs. About 10% of Oregonians still don't have medical insurance. Those who have it often can't afford the services because of high copayments. We rank 31st in per capita public health spending, some 20% below the median. Senior services, about two-thirds of Oregon retirees have no personal retirement savings. The last 10 years, there's been a 61% increase in the number of seniors living in poverty. And all of this is the starting point for the fact that we're facing a $1.4 billion budget deficit, and legislators are talking about cuts of maybe 7 to 10% in those programs. So I think you have to start by saying we have desperate need for money to adequately fund key services. And when you start from that point, you say, well, where do we get the money? And immediately you realize, if you look at the data, that the problem isn't that individuals aren't paying taxes or small businesses aren't paying taxes, but it's the largest corporations that have been steadily getting away without having to pay taxes. About 30 years ago, they paid about 18 or 19% of all the income taxes in the state. Now they're down to about 6.7% of all the income taxes and on their way down to about 4% in the next 5 or 6 years. So Measure 97, which was so brilliant about it, is designed to tax the largest corporations and direct the funds to early childhood education, K-12 education, healthcare, and senior services. So it seemed to me, as an economist who was looking at this, seeing the need, seeing who's getting away without paying taxes, and seeing a measure that is very well focused to raise the funds and direct them, was a no-brainer. All the people who study state economies, Economic Policy Institute, Urban Institute, they're very clear that one of the best things a state can do to have a strong state economy is to get an adequate funding basis for the state that's sufficient to fund education and health care. And all the studies show that achieving that is the best policy a state can have for generating a strong economy with jobs, income growth, and high quality of life. And if we don't pass this measure now, we're going to keep going down the road to an ever worsening economy.
Marty, the people, though, who would pay the tax, they also may recognize that, but they don't want to pay that tax. Their line is basically that you're wrong, Marty. This is just a sales tax in disguise because we're going to, this is the implication of everything they say, and they're spending many millions saying it over and over and over on TV and other places, direct mail, that what we do and what all companies must do is just pass tax increases on to all corporations have to do it. You just pass the tax increases on to the people. And so all of their electricity and food and everything else is going to be passed on to the consumers. It's just a sales tax. Now, that, of course, isn't true. Tell us what they're saying and why not.
Sure. I mean, I think what you just said there is a good starting place. The opponents often say this is a disguised sales tax, and the fact of the matter is it's not a sales tax. And here we need just a little bit of history. Oregon had a $10 minimum tax from the 1930s to 2010. And in 2010, Oregon voters passed a measure to create a higher minimum tax on corporations because corporations were, in fact, not paying enough in taxes and we had great needs. And what that measure did was create 12 brackets. And each bracket said, depending on how much a company sold, what their sales were in Oregon, they had to pay a certain amount. This focus on sales, a tax on sales, was what the Oregon Business Association wanted. And so that was how the measure was structured, and that's how people passed it. Measure 97 does not change the tax code. It does not introduce some new tax, some new sales tax. It just collapses the top four brackets and increases the amount that companies who sell more than $25 million, who have more than $25 million in in-state sales, will have to pay in taxes. So first of all, it's not a radical new tax. And it's not a sales tax. A sales tax is something you go into a store, you buy a product, and there's an additional tax put on it. This is a tax on company sales. And to show you the differences, there are four other states that have sort of a tax like this, and they also have sales taxes. They have both. Oregon, this is not a sales tax. The second thing to say is that the Oregon Legislative Revenue Office, which did a study of using past tax records and sales, has made very clear that only 1,000 companies in the entire state will be affected by this higher tax because the minimum standard is quite high. There aren't that many companies that have more than $25 million in Oregon sales. There's only 1,000 of them. That's less than 1% of all the businesses in Oregon, and it's only 3.5% of all the corporations in Oregon. So it's not a new tax, but it raises the tax on very few companies. Now, why are we who support this tax so confident that consumers won't pay it?
Yeah, that's the question.
The reason is that, again, the greatest number of firms that are going to pay this tax tend to be in retail. There are companies like Safeway, Kroger, Target. Most of these companies have national pricing strategies, and you can even buy a lot of their goods online. Amazon, places like that. So what that means is that you can actually study this, and people have done studies showing that the same product, say, at a Kroger store in throughout Oregon and Washington and Idaho, same prices for the same product. Target, same prices for the same product in all the states that they operate in. They do not adjust prices by state taxation systems. So there's every reason to believe that if you force these companies to pay higher taxes, they're going to absorb these taxes into their profits,
yeah,
which have been quite substantial.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole. I'm talking to Marty Hart Landsberg, who taught at Lewis and Clark. He's still writing. He has his blog is the Reports from the Economic Front. It's immensely valuable. He's in support of Measure 97. We've gone really into mostly like the few corporations in the state, relatively few, 1,000 of them out of many, 100,000.
400,000.
400,000, yeah. Why those companies are not going to raise their prices. But there seems to be another reason why they can't raise their prices, Marty. They have a pricing strategy. They're in competitive markets, and they're aiming for a set of consumers. And they know, and they design their stores in order to remain competitive against these set of consumers. And the competition is like from Amazon as well as many, many small stores. If they raise their prices, they lose their customer base. And in their pricing strategies, this is all sort of known. It's all studied. There's marketing professors and whole industries that are devoted to figuring out pricing strategies that maximize their income. And they really can't change that. And relatively small for them, change in taxes in one state is not something that they would do. Because they have
exactly.
to retain them, their
I mean,
position.
There are several parts to that. And what you said is very true, and I want to just emphasize a few parts. First, not every company who operates in the state is going to be taxed. In many markets, you're talking about one company or two companies. And because of competition with other companies whose tax requirements aren't going up because they're not as big, those big companies aren't going to want to lose market share, just what you said. Secondly, because of online retailing, because of consumer markets, these firms, the bigger firms, are not going to want to start to change their prices because of losing market share. Now, people think about groceries. You go to a Kroger, Kroger will have to pay more money. But that doesn't mean that every business that sells a product in a Fred Meyer, which is owned by Kroger, those products, those businesses themselves aren't being taxed higher. They're not going to change their prices. Kroger isn't going to be able to go around and order everybody, every product in the store, every company to raise prices. Kroger is going to have to absorb the higher tax that it has here in Oregon and meld it out, as you mentioned, across its national pricing strategies, which is why their pricing strategy is national. They don't change things. The other thing that's really important to note is, and charges have been made, but the studies are very clear, Oregon has the lowest tax burden on businesses relative to their profits of any state in the United States. There's a group called the Anderson Economic Group, which is funded by corporations, that does yearly studies of every state to determine how heavy the tax burden is relative to business profits. And they get the records, public records, and they do it every single year. And it's used by businesses to kind of get a sense of what state taxing environments are like. And for three consecutive years, Oregon has ranked at the bottom, meaning that the tax burden on business relative to their profits is the lowest of every state in the United States. We certainly don't have the lowest prices of every state in the United States, despite having the lowest burden. And if we raise Measure 97, according to the Anderson study, we're about $3.5 billion below the median tax burden in the United States. So if we pass Measure 97, the estimates are we'd be getting another $3 billion in tax revenue.
And we remain a low-tax state.
Exactly. This is not going to jeopardize the profitability of Target, of Albertsons, of Safeway, of Kroger, of Wells Fargo, of Bank of America. They are going to be able to absorb it. And that's why we who support this are relatively confident that these taxes will not be translated into prices. But the other side that's often missing is the benefits of this tax measure. The fact is that if you have early childhood education programs, and we only fund about 30% of the children who are eligible for these programs, you have kids who are going to be getting good education, you have families who can now go out to work. If you have good senior support services, you will reduce the costs of many working class families. I mean, who's going to be the beneficiaries of a good quality public education, good quality early childhood education, good senior services, access to better health care? It's going to be working people. the overwhelming majority of the benefits of these tax revenues are going to go to the people who need it. And it's going to strengthen their ability to live good lives, to be working more productively. And in fact, if you have a stable tax base, which we don't have now, but the studies show this tax would give us that, with good education, good health care, that's one of the best ways to be attracting new business investment, creating, you know, new job creation. So this is a very strong pro-economic stability, economic gain, with the benefits targeted very much to working Oregonians.
One thing that I'd like to talk about just for a second, I'll make a sort of hypothesis, and I'm always uncomfortable when on our show we talk about development and rebuilding the economy and strengthening the economy and growing the economy, if it can be interpreted that way, because at some level, if we keep growing the economy, we're going to exhaust the atmosphere and the ecosystems on which we're dependent for life. I'm sure you agree with that. We have to begin talking about building an economy that's fair for everybody, where there are really tremendously reduced greenhouse gas emissions. I think that's another part, though, of the economic development thing that has to be talked about. Measure 97 is absolutely necessary, even for attaining the kind of economy that can be then where greenhouse gas emissions and other environmental threats can be reduced. My guess is you agree, but why don't you comment and then we'll sign off.
Well, I do. I mean, Measure 97 means that some of these key social areas that are really vital to any kind of economic vision you have to have a healthy population. You want to have a well-educated population. How do you support that? Instead of draining state funds away from mass transit and all sorts of other policies that can create a different kind of economy, we can begin to sort of say, okay, these core social programs are now funded, and the existing budget, instead of each year, we're falling farther behind in these other areas, we're draining money away from other things, we'd be able to use the money we have in those other programs to begin to redirect the economy in kind of the ways you're talking about. Right now, the problem is at each step, because the state budget is not sufficient to do things, we keep saying, well, let's put money into education.
Yeah, let's cut environmental protection, which we're beginning to realize is a disaster. Marty.
And mass transit and all sorts of things like that.
Right. Marty, great talking to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you. And I encourage everybody out there to vote yes for Measure 97. It's absolutely a critical starting point for rethinking our own economy and our own lives.
And if you want to learn more, what website should people go to?
I would say that the Oregon Center for Public Policy has been doing some great work on Measure 97. Vote yes on Measure 97. The website for the measure has also some great stuff.
Thanks a lot. So long.
Thank you, Bill. Bye-bye.
And this is the OMO Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Now Todd Sloan is here to share his insights on the psychological effects of oppression, which was the subject of a workshop he recently led at the annual meeting of the journal Psychoanalysis, Culture, and Society. Todd?
Welcome to another episode in our ongoing series on the psychology of activism. Organizers working for social justice often wonder why people who are sufficiently informed about issues that affect them in major ways do not immediately act and work for social change. There are, of course, many obstacles like lack of time, need for childcare, work schedules, lack of understanding of social movements, and so forth. Because of these things, many of us limit our activism to sending a check, signing a petition, or clicking like on Facebook and hoping that such acts will pile up and make a difference. There are, however, what might be called psychological obstacles to action, and these are more complicated than simple fear of retaliation or laziness or procrastination. These psychological obstacles are embedded in our character structures and defense mechanisms as a result of experiencing domination, oppression, marginalization, and exclusion. This means it should be fruitful to turn to psychoanalysis, the science of unconscious psychological processes. We could ask, for example, what can psychoanalysts tell us about the ways in which we are shaped psychologically by the various forms of oppression that we experience as we are growing up and living out in our adult lives? And how would understanding these effects of oppression inform practices such as consciousness raising, community organizing, and mobilization efforts for social and environmental justice? These questions were actually the topic of a workshop at a recent meeting of the Association for the Psychoanalysis of Culture and Society at Rutgers University in New Jersey. Most of the participants in the workshop were psychotherapists or psychoanalysts with a few academics in the human sciences. I personally found the discussion especially relevant to our efforts as organizers struggling to mobilize people to participate in progressive social movements, so I share some general conclusions here. First of all, by oppression, we had in mind constraints and subjection that people experience as members of a group due to marginalization, exclusion, discrimination, structural violence, such as poverty, and direct violence. This would include, of course, sexism, racism, homophobia, classism, as well as ableism, ageism, and other less recognized forms of oppression. How do these experiences of oppression leave their traces in the structure and functioning of the psyche? We usually tend to gloss over the complexities here with simple references to, for example, trauma or complexes, or abstract terms like alienation or marginalization. We also tend to lump together all sorts of oppression and violence and domination. These are obviously not the same. But to illustrate what the workshop discussed, we'll briefly discuss focus on oppression related to classism, in particular the ways in which the psyche is shaped by experiences of class oppression, rendering workers less capable of recognizing exploitation at work and less likely to join with others to change working conditions, for example, by having the courage to unionize or to go on strike. This is obviously not a case of blockage due to a one-time traumatic experience, although there may be exemplary experiences of violence in individual lives, such as bullying or parental abuse, that might be organized along class lines. The effects of classism over one's life settle into clusters of memories and experiences that generate interpretations of oneself in relation to powerful or privileged others as inadequate, weak, isolated, different, shameful, humiliated, embarrassed, etc. These experiences might occur at home with authoritarian parents, or at school with teachers prone to shaming less prepared students, or on the playground, or in the neighborhood where many forms of cruelty are practiced, or in the city where differences of wealth are obvious while shopping or just walking around. They could also be related to the media, where lower socioeconomic classes are portrayed in stereotyped ways, or are simply absent from most programming. The memories and self-images linked to these experiences coalesce into a generalized psychological stance that is activated when one finds oneself in social scenarios where class position, status, economic power are in play. For example, in a personal meeting with the boss, a meeting of workers with management, a meeting of renters and landlords. In some cases, the psychological stance may lead to resistance, revolt, or sabotage, for example. But what we mostly need to understand better are the stances that get labeled as apathy, passivity, dejection, submission, withdrawal, and bystanding while others experience oppression more directly. How can we best understand these limiting psychological stances? First, we can notice that as a result of experiences of class oppression, the psychic structure may be characterized by things like constraints on imagination and agency, because there are prohibitions on expression, expansiveness, and creativity. There might be rigid identifications with dominant ideas or authority figures, and little freedom for exploration of negative feelings that might develop into a more critical and questioning attitude. There might be self-evaluations that are either idealized or denigrated as inferior, and in general, a lack of congruence between thought, feeling, and action. Second, we should also develop a concept of how the psyche might be structured if these experiences of class or other oppressions were not frequent, pervasive, or eventually powerful as they accumulate over time. One would find instead greater freedom of play between impulses, desires, sensations, and imagination and memories, greater agency and capacity for connection and relationship, congruence of thought, feeling, and action, fuller and more complex meaning-making, deep awareness of and stronger responses to acts of oppression that are occurring in the present. Now, when we turn to what practices of organizing should take into account in light of this, we need to keep in mind that the primary tasks are to enhance a person's capacity to make sense of what is going on, both emotionally and relationally, to articulate experiences, to give voice to their suffering, to feel recognized and heard by others, and to develop trust and solidarity with a group of others who are also affected or acting in alliance with one's group. It's also important to remember, finally, that organizing practices that support the overcoming of psychological effects of oppression go far beyond simple education and information. Ideally, they mobilize the senses and the body through the arts, music, poetry, spirituality, dance, and connection to the rest of nature. They should also be deeply dialogical in order to ensure time to listen and understand what all have been experiencing and to foster visions of better futures. These are the sorts of practices that can address and overcome the psychological effects of oppression. This is Todd Sloan for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Far between sundown's finish and midnight's broken toll, we ducked inside the doorways, thunder went crashing. As majestic bells of bolts struck shadows in the sounds, seeming to be the chimes of freedom flashing. Flashing for the warriors whose strength is not to fight, flashing for the refugees on the unarmed road of flight, and for each and every underdog soldier in the night. And we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing. Through the city's melted furnace, unexpectedly we watched, with faces hidden as the walls were tightening. As the echo of the wedding bells before the blowing rain dissolved into the bells of the lightning, tolling for the rebel, tolling for the rake, tolling for the luckless, they are abandoned and forsaken, tolling for the outcast, burning constantly at stake. And we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing.
The G4S is a UK-based security multinational which has admitted to having personnel deployed at remote sites where Native Americans are defending their lands from the planned Dakota Access Pipeline that they say would pollute the drinking water of millions. The security company has also been under fire for providing services to Israeli prisons and settlements. Desiree Hellegers interviews Maxine Fuchsun of Jewish Voice for Peace and Peter Miller of Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights about G4S's Portland City contracts.
So my guests today are Maxine Fuchsun and Peter Miller, both from Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights and Jewish Voice for Peace. And both organizations are also part of the Coalition for an Occupation-Free Portland. And we're speaking today about G4S, which is one of the security companies with which the city of Portland contracts, as well as more recently in the news for involvement in the security at Standing Rock, and also well known, I think, for its role in the occupation of Palestine.
Yeah, so here in Portland, we have Occupation Free Portland's had a campaign to get four companies complicit with Israel's occupation: Caterpillar, Motorola Solutions, Hewlett-Packard, and G4S on the city's Do Not Buy list for investments. The city has a social responsible investment policy, and they have a committee that's been looking at companies that the city might be investing in, and they agreed with us on Caterpillar to put Caterpillar along with 10 other companies on the city's Do Not Buy list. So they have a report that's going to City Council, and City Council will decide on this whole Do Not Buy list November 30th at a City Council meeting.
As Peter mentioned, we have Occupation Free Portland has four companies. G4S, that we're going to talk more about, is one of them, and it was not discussed this year by the Socially Responsible Investment Committee, so it'll still be something to be considered at a later date. And so this year, the only company we, Occupation Free Portland, brought forward for divestment, or Do Not Buy, as it's called, Do Not Buy the Investments with this company, is Caterpillar.
But you would like to see G4S added to that list?
Absolutely.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about why.
First off, G4S is the largest security company in the world. It has over 600,000 employees worldwide, and that also makes it the third largest private company in the world after Walmart and Foxconn. Foxconn is the company that makes the iPhone. So it has a huge security presence. In the United States alone, U.S. government outsourcing for manned security people, G4S accounts for 25% of that outsourcing. So it's a huge company and has a huge impact in the security realm. And so it's been complicit in a lot of problems globally, as you might expect with a security company, problems with abuse of prisoners, abuse of minors in prison, all sorts of malfeasance of the guards. For us, it's a deep involvement with the occupation of Palestine and running prisons and helping to run prisons that have Palestinian political prisoners, have Palestinian children. Israel imprisons a large number of Palestinian children in its prisons. And so we're trying to get G4S to be held accountable for these human rights violations that it supports.
And it's been a company specifically around the issues in Israel-Palestine. As Peter mentioned, G4S is one of the companies that's most heavily profiting from the occupation. So they're responsible for things like security apparatus in the largest of the prisons in Israel where political prisoners are held, Palestinian political prisoners. So the surveillance, the guarding, they don't actually have the personnel there, but it's all the infrastructure of the prison is where G4S is active. They're also, they do scanning machines at checkpoints, at border crossings like the Erez border from Israel into Gaza. The luggage that's scanned is by G4S products. And all of the kinds of involvement that G4S have is really illegal under international law. They do some of the guarding. They have G4S guards in some of the illegal Israeli settlements on the West Bank, at Ariel University, which is a university on the West Bank. So the West Bank, of course, is Palestinian land and is under occupation by Israel. So G4S is really providing infrastructure to uphold parts of that occupation. So it's been a company very well researched, engaged with, to try to get them to change their ways. And we can say more about that because they are saying that they're going to get out of Israel. They've made that promise for a couple of years, and I think the last time was maybe 2014 or 2015, that they will within 2 years leave Israel. So churches, they've been a target company for divestment campaigns. And really, until the company actually follows through with what they say they're going to do, getting out of Israel-Palestine, the call to boycott and divest from them stands. And the other thing that I saw, I took a trip a year ago now to the U.S.-Mexico border. So G4S has a contract with Homeland Security, with ICE, to do all of the transportation of people who are in detention and awaiting deportation. So to get them from where they're apprehended when they're crossing the border to the detention center, to the courtroom, back to the detention center, and then back to be deported is all in these big, you see the G4S vans going, or buses going down the highway. And a vivid recollection that I have was right at the border, we were doing a vigil, and a family, mom and her children, being taken onto a G4S bus to, I guess, be transported to a family detention center.
Was so, the bus marked G4S, or did you manage
it? It wasn't marked G4S, but one of the people that was at, the people that were leading the vigil who work down in that area, said that it was a G4S bus. And they do, they are the sole Homeland Security transportation. They have right. a contract.
Right.
To the transportation.
I notice here in the American Friends Service Committee report that G4S even has a official promotional brochure about this busing, which is called The Bus No One Wants to Catch, The End of the Road for Illegal Immigrants. So they're actively promoting this deportation process.
Absolutely. And, you know, the stories that we heard down at the border that were happening were that in extremely hot conditions, people in the process of being detained or deported were left on hot, closed buses for hours, not given any water, not given any food, not allowed off the bus to use the restroom. It's families, it's children. So there's a lot of concern from the immigration rights movement about G4S as well. One of the things that Portland looks at least for their investment criteria, as Peter mentioned, the socially responsible investment policy, is that there's a list of criteria, and what they're looking for is companies that have violations in multiple areas of practices that go against socially responsible investing. And G4S certainly does, as we've talked about, the human rights abuse, labor violations in terms of how they treat their employees in African prisons. They're a big company that runs prison security in Africa. So there's been charges of racism. A group of guards in Africa went on strike protesting the conditions of employment under G4S. In Great Britain, there's been concerns. There's been concerns about how G4S runs youth detention centers, allegations of abuse, and including sexual abuse. And in fact, G4S has said they're going to get out of the youth detention business because there's so many complaints about them, but so far, again, we haven't seen them follow through on that promise.
And I think, like the Social Responsible Investment Committee, one thing that really they were seemed to be very sensitive to was this whole problem of private prisons and the privatization of security. Mm-hmm. And so one of the companies on the Do Not Buy list, and deservedly for a lot of things, is Wells Fargo. And Wells Fargo was one of the target companies by the group in Lhasa dealing with private prisons. Fargo has invested so heavily in private prisons. And G4S is just another one of these private security companies. You know, this capitalism of misery where companies are profiting off of imprisoning people and all sorts of malfeasance is you know, kind of a runaway capitalism in, you know, our view.
Yeah, interesting to note that it was previously known as Wackenhut, right?
Right.
So that might be how a lot
right.
of the listeners recognize.
So they're a British-Danish company, but they purchased Wackenhut. So now Wackenhut is part of this giant conglomerate of security.
G4S.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, and I think the question here in Portland that exists around G4S is, as Peter mentioned, right now our campaign is looking at investments that the city has or potentially could have. Though there is no investment right now with G4S, and they probably aren't in the category of where the city would invest. But we want to make sure that they get put on a do not buy list. And actually, that's consistent with other, when the city divested from fossil fuel companies, not all of them were actually in our portfolio, but it's the theoretical question of, you know, making sure that they go on a list that we wouldn't buy from them. But the city does have a contract with G4S. They do the security in some of the city buildings at the Amtrak station. It's a multiple-year contract. The G4S employees who work for the city are unionized with SEIU Local 49. So I think the question arises and was asked even by the Socially Responsible Investment Committee members, certainly by us, if we have a policy that informs us how we should invest our money, our taxpayer money, should we not have the same policy for how we decide on who we're going to have contracts with? So I think that's a question for some future organizing to think about, that maybe G4S is not a company. In fact, I would say it is not a company that we want to have contracts with.
And those are G4S security guards who are also guarding City Hall right now, is my understanding.
Right. City Hall the city office building and Amtrak, I think, are the buildings that I know of.
Which sort of maybe raises questions about the events that transpired about 10 days ago at City mm-hmm. Hall, right, where protesters were ejected. And the question of to what extent are we sort of tracking potential abuses that may occur by G4S workers versus the mechanisms that we have for tracking and dealing with abuses among Portland City Police.
The police, yeah.
I think one of the things raised again by the Socially Responsible Investment Committee is on the procurement side. The city, if a company is bad enough not to invest in, it's probably bad enough not to do business with or try not to. If a company is bad enough not to invest in, it's probably bad enough not to do business with or try not to, or at least avoid if possible. And G4S seems to fall in that category. So while the SRI committee is not mandated to look at that procurement side and is maybe reluctant to look at companies that aren't investing in, maybe the city ought to widen that scope. And a good example of this is Wells Fargo, because Wells Fargo is definitely on the proposed do not buy list. And given the news of Wells Fargo lately, with all the fake bank accounts it's been, its employees were ginning up to, make them look good. It's clear, I think, the city is probably going to keep it on the do not buy list. But the city also uses Wells Fargo as one of its main bankers for city money. So then the question is, obviously, should we, the city, be using Wells Fargo as one of its bankers or try to find a bank that's more local to Oregon?
Yeah, I mean, the symbolic significance to me also of having G4S guarding City Hall is fairly significant, I think. Mm-hmm. And it also raises questions about the relative costs of contracting with a private corporation versus providing those services public and unionized workers.
Yeah, exactly. And the city of Durham, North Carolina, dumped G4S. So they got the city to break their contract. And one of the things we were concerned about when we considered that as where we were going to go first with our movement, it was obviously we don't want to take jobs away from people, and particularly people who are unionized. And we also don't want to do anything against the union that we support. They're allies of ours. So the good thing is that there are other companies with unionized security workers. So how they worked it in Durham was that those who lost their job when G4S was eliminated were given the first chance to be rehired when the city contracted with another security firm. And according to SEIU, that would be able to happen here should that transpire, that we do end the contract. I think most of us felt like it was also a difficult thing to break a contract rather than to wait until it's ended and then urge the city to not renegotiate it. So I think that might be a strategy. Mm-hmm. Is it possible to turn the conversation for a minute just to what's happening right now with divestment? Because it is in a kind of critical time right now. So we have gone through, as Peter said, through the Socially Responsible Investment Committee, along with our allies and LACE. And our lens is around the grievances against the violations of SRI policy of Caterpillar and LACE with Wells Fargo. So for us, there's so many areas that Caterpillar is one bad company, really. Caterpillar violates 6 of the 7 of the city's socially responsible investment criteria, including, of course, the really atrocious violations of human rights in Palestine through demolitions of homes, villages, infrastructure, construction of the apartheid wall, of segregated highways.
Now we're also seeing the use of Caterpillar at Standing Rock
as well.
At Standing
Rock, absolutely.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. You look at the pictures of Standing Rock, and you sort of feel like you've been transported back to Palestine because you see these monster machines rolling through the lands of indigenous people and basically trampling on their rights. And it's also interesting that G4S also has had some security people working with the Standing Rock, at Standing Rock with the Dakota Pipeline. So all these companies seem to come together at different times things like this.
They're intersectional, too.
They're intersectional, that's right.
As well as us. So, and if listeners are interested in doing something right now to support both ENLACE, for Wells Fargo divestment, as well as Occupation Free Portland and Caterpillar divestment. This is time until October 31st for public comment to be submitted to the City Council in support of the SRI recommendations for divestment from these companies or putting them on the do not buy list. And the way to submit public comment is you can go to the occupationfreepdx.org website. That's our website. So it's occupationfreepdx.org. And right on the top of the homepage, there's a link to the city's public comment site.
Okay, and the City Council meeting again is on November
30th.
30th?
At 2 p.m.
Great. Okay.
Yeah, be there. We want to fill the chambers.
Okay.
That's right.
Great. Well, thank you so much. My guests today have been Peter Miller and Maxine Fuchsen with Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights and Jewish Voice for Peace, also part of the Coalition for an Occupation-Free Portland. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Desiree.
Thanks, Desiree.
You're listening to the OMO Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Today I'd like to share with you excerpts from an article by David Rosen entitled "The War on Drugs is a Racket." On a recent segment of Democracy Now!, Tess Borden made an impassioned plea for the U.S., both federal and state governments, to end the criminal prosecution of those possessing or using illegal drugs. Quoting from a new report from the ACLU and Human Rights Watch, HRW, Borden observed, "Every 25 seconds, someone is arrested for possessing drugs for their own use, amounting to 1.25 million arrests per year." She reminded her audience, "These numbers tell a tale of ruined lives, destroyed families, and communities suffering under a suffocating police presence." The study is an impressive piece of rigorous research and analysis, as well as a statement of moral conviction. It's a political call to decriminalize all personal drug use. It paints a devastating portrait of not simply the nation's failed anti-drug policy, but reveals it to be a mean-spirited, moralistic, and racist program of social repression. A bust every 25 seconds adds up. As the study reminds readers, tens of thousands of people are convicted, cycled through jails and prisons, and spend extended periods on probation and parole, often burdened with crippling debt from court-imposed fines and fees. Among the study's key findings are, yes, every 25 seconds someone in the U.S. is arrested for the simple act of possessing drugs for their personal use. Sadly, more than 1.25 million people are arrested each year for drug possession. This is more than for any other crime. More than one of every nine arrests by state law enforcement is for drug possession. Four times more people are arrested for possessing drugs as for selling them. There are at least 137,000 men and women in prison for drug possession, 48,000 in state pens, and 89,000 in local jails, most in pretrial detention. This population consists predominantly of inner-city dwellers, African-American and Hispanic, and largely youthful offenders. In 42 states, possession of small amounts of most illicit drugs other than marijuana is either always or sometimes a felony offense. Only eight states in the District of Columbia make possession of small amounts a misdemeanor. The study makes clear that the war on drugs is a punitive, vindictive form of policing, criminal justice, and imprisonment. It's easy to be tough on those involved in mostly a victimless crime. Cops pick the easiest target, notably inner-city minority youth, for example, stop and frisk, and increasingly rural white youth. Prosecutors show off how tough they are by throwing the book at some hapless soul, and judges get easily reelected for being tough on drug criminals, especially people of color and repeat offenders. The study makes clear that the war on drugs is a failure in terms of public policy and the toll it takes on those suffocated by the drug war effort. Unfortunately, the study suffers from not pushing its inherent argument one critical step further, acknowledging that the police court jail system that manages the drug war is a racket, the domestic corollary to the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower identified a half a century ago. No one knows how much money has been spent to fight the failed war on drugs. According to a DPA estimate, over the past four decades, federal and state governments have poured over $1 trillion into drug war spending and relied on taxpayers to foot the bill. It adds, money funneled into drug enforcement has meant less funding for more serious crime and has left essential education, health, social service, and public safety programs struggling to operate on meager funding. The War on Drugs website provides a detailed breakdown on annual federal spending on the war on drugs from 2013 to 17. It estimates for fiscal year 2016 the federal government will spend $30.6 billion. A third source, the Drug War Clock, estimates the federal spending is about 60% of that spent by states. Total spending for the false war on drugs is about $75 billion. The expenditures associated with the war on drugs are, like the military-industrial complex, a vast slush fund with costs covering a very wide assortment of federal, state, and local, both government and private, services and fees. Among these expenditures are costs of policing, from the border guards to the cop on the block, costs of prosecutors, courts, and defense attorneys, costs for prisons, jails, and probation. These areas of expenditures do not itemize the direct costs for employment facilities and upkeep, let alone the profits garnered by private corporations to operate the vast infrastructure required to wage the war on drugs. Nor do these expenditures include the $1 trillion that Americans spent on illegal substances between 2000 and 2010. In 2012, a study for the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, RAND estimated the market for four illicit drugs, cocaine, heroin, marijuana, and meth, at $100 billion for only 1 year, 2010. It noted, this figure has been stable over the decade, but there have been important shifts in the drugs being purchased. With a $100 billion in illegal drug money sloshing through the economy each year, one can only wonder how much of it goes to corruption payoffs, to law enforcement officials who look the other way. As experienced during Prohibition, the enormous cash generated by the illegal drug trade leads to endemic corruption. Finally, as the ACLU an HRW study painfully makes clear, many, many people's lives are destroyed for the possession of illegal drugs. Unfortunately, it doesn't mention the way questionable law enforcement officials, like the notorious Brooklyn NYPD detective Louis Scarsella and former DA Charles Hines, exploited drug busts to further their careers. New York has paid more than $100 million to wrongfully convicted victims of their arrests and prosecutions. It's time to embrace the ACLU and HRW's call to end the criminal prosecution of those who possess or use illegal substances. Like alcohol, it needs to be integrated into the market, and like alcohol, effectively regulated in terms of quality and age of use. Sadly, like the military-industrial complex, too many corporations, unions, and people with influence have too much invested in the war on drugs to see it end. That was an article by David Rosen entitled "Me: The War on Drugs is a Racket." That was a very condensed version. The complete article can be found on the Counterpunch webpage. Rosen is the author of Sex, Sin, and Subversion, the transformation of 1950s New York's forbidden into America's new normal. And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patsy Kohlberg has been our engineer. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the mole's point of view. That is, from the ground up. As moles, we seek to explore alternative possibilities for our cultural, social, and political lives to move beyond the hegemony of unfettered global capitalism and a culture of consumerism, exploitation, and environmental devastation. We agitate for a new order in which not only humanity, but other species as well, can thrive and lead fulfilling lives within ecologically sustainable environments. From the mole's perspective, such effective change can only come about through grassroots democratic struggles that chip away at existing power structures in an effort to create more just and equitable communities, both locally and internationally. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. Today's program will be podcast on the KBOO website in the next day or two. You can listen to the entire program or specific segments. You can also find links to more information about guests and topics, as well as past programs. And speaking of Todd's piece, somebody wanted to know how they could learn more about it, and apparently there's a Facebook page called Cascadia Center for Social Ecology. by Todd Sloan. So you can look that up. And if you're listening, Bob Dylan, please phone the Nobel Laureate or the Nobel Prize Committee.